Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, episode 318. I'm Patrick Gray. It is a four-day week this week and a four-day week next week because of the Easter break, so I'm afraid I couldn't actually organise feature interviews for both weeks. So this week, you're getting an extra long news section and a sponsor interview. Sorry about that, just works out that way sometimes. But this week's show is brought to you by Sanitas, the makers of fine, fine Layer 2 encryption gear. If you are planning a greenfield network, you have absolutely no excuse to not check out their stuff. It rocks like a banana on its back. And this week we are joined by Sanitas CEO Andrew Wilson in the sponsor slot. He'll be talking about a Privacy Act readiness survey Sanitas did that yielded some genuinely depressing results. Yeah, you just wait. You'll know what I mean by that later. He also compares director-level attitudes in InfoSec to director-level attitudes to occupational health and safety issues 50 years ago. And it's a really, really interesting and compelling take. So do stick around for that. But we're going to jump right into it now. It is time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good buddy, Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau. And Adam, last week's show was dominated by Heartbleed news, but now we have a face we can associate with, you know, with this terrible internet threat. It is 19-year-old Canadian Stephen Solis Reyes. And he has apparently been arrested by the Mounties for using Heartbleed to steal data from a government website.
Yeah, this man is he's a real criminal. He certainly has the face of a criminal. Was arrested by the RCMP wearing their fine hats, I'm sure, for, as you say, stealing sensitive customer data from the Canadian taxation service. Now, it's not entirely clear what the impact of that data theft was, but for him, the impact appears to be Mounties on his doorstep at the crack of dawn, and he's going down.
Now, if you want to see something terrifying, I would urge you to get into this week's show notes and click through to the link that we've provided to Fairfax Media, where you will see a picture of this man who's, terrifying, very criminal moustache is probably running at about, what would you say, 20, 30% coverage?
Yeah, it's, poor dude is, he's still in like the baby fuzz stage, it appears. Maybe it's not a recent photo. Maybe he now has a thorough, ravishing manly beard, but...
Or maybe it's a full-on handlebar, like a bike, biker style. This is like one of the dorkiest people you've ever seen. It's like, and I kind of feel sorry for him because it looks like someone's pulled like a yearbook photo or something, and it's just, it's awful. If I get arrested for a crime, I don't want a photo like this appearing in the newspapers. It would be, hard to look like a badass when you look like that guy.
Poor dude. But anyway, apparently he was son of a computer science professor, and we don't really know the circumstances under which he was doing stuff with the Heartbleed blog, whether he was just testing it and, it went horribly wrong, or, whether he was actually intending to do some manner of crime. But either way, it's the first arrest that we've seen out of the Heartbleed drama.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm guessing he was just messing around, it's...
you'd think so.
But... Yeah, you would think so. But luckily he was arrested in Canada and not in the United States, because in Canada he'll probably, get off with a six-month good behavior bond, whereas in the US he'd probably be in prison.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Now, we have seen some real attacks. Obviously, there's a lot of people out there. Because of the ease of exploitation of Heartbleed, you just have to ask for a big, heartbeat or whatever it is. You get 64, 65K of memory come back at you. So, there's a lot of people going buck wild with it, according to this post from ThreatPost.
Yeah, one of the examples cited here is the UK parenting site Mumsnet was having credentials stolen.
And then, oh my God, Cybergeddon.
I know, exactly. Like all these banks are running around, changing all their certs, reissuing everything, revoking all their certs, changing all their passwords, getting everyone in the world to change their passwords because we're 11 out of 10. And Mumsnet and the Canada Revenue Agency lost 900 people's worth of data. And of course the KiwiCon IRC server was serving up priv messages. But other than that, we haven't really seen the 11 out of 10 cyberpocalypse that the old mate Schneier predicted, but I'm sure we will actually see some examples of real crime being done with this bug. But so far, they're not really rolling in, are they?
No, they're not. But you're going to imagine that this is the type of bug that's going to throw up a lot of card data. I mean, you know, you can imagine there's a lot of e-commerce sites that just aren't patched against this. So, you know, if you're some sort of Cardiforum dude or dudette, you know, you can just keep scanning, find a site that actually coughs up memory, and, you know, you throw your Heartbleed requests at a bunch of sites and they're going to come back with card data. So it's, I think it's a matter of time before we see card dumps kind of tied to this bug. I mean, you'd have to expect that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there certainly will be some real things being done with it. And we, you know, we've seen piecemeal examples, but yeah, a widespread, you know, really big one, you know, it's probably, you know, that story is still being written somewhere on somebody's network.
Mm. Now, Netcraft says that of the 500,000 affected servers, only 80,000 have revoked their keys, which they say are low. And the reporting seems to say that's low, but I'm thinking, you know, geez, one in six, that's actually pretty good after after a week, you know? I mean, because you got to think 80,000 of them, they're probably going to be more towards the top most trafficked ones. I mean, a lot of those sites are going to be, you know, sites like mine where I don't really handle sensitive data. I'm actually not going to bother revoking my key because I don't even take user registrations anymore. Do you know what I mean? So the fact that 80,000 sites have revoked their certificates so far, that's actually a win. I put that in the win column.
Yeah, actually, yeah, me too. Totally agree with you there. Like the fact that you know, anyone did anything at all, right, in terms of you know, what we normally expect from internet security is amazing.
Yeah, I was expecting more like 800, not 80,000.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, and of course, the difference or the distinction here is that they're talking about revocations as opposed to rekeying. So I think the point that they're trying to make is that whilst plenty of people are in fact going out and reissuing their certs, that not everybody is then continuing onwards to actually revoke the old certificates. And the point there is, of course, old certificate that was stolen is still valid.
Middle possibilities. How's that going to tie in with cert pinning, though? I mean, I'm wondering if you revoke your old certificate, I mean, are they cached? Is it going to make Chrome go all wonky? Is it going to mess with Firefox? I mean, could that be a reason why people aren't revoking just yet?
That's actually a good question. I'm not sure about the interaction with, you know, the sort of cert pinning we see in Chrome or you know, HSTS in general. I don't actually know. I probably should know the answer to that question. Given my job to know the answer to that kind of thing.
Well, it's taken 7.5 years, but he is stumped.
No, it's good question, actually. I mean, you know, that kind of cert pinning doesn't seem to be super widespread. We don't see a lot of HSTS amongst our customers at the moment, but yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. It's not going to be a large percentage. I would have thought that would be you know, in that category of not having to worry about it because of HSTS or cert pinning or whatever else. Mm. But yeah, it's you know, overall, I think the you know, the hype that we've seen around Heartbleed, you know, has really driven quite strong patching. I mean, even if we compare it to you know, the Kaminsky DNS bug or the Padding Oracle bug or even the NTP DDoS, as we've seen, and the NTP DDoS has got fixed pretty quickly because there was DDoS going around and people's, you know, availability was impacted. But for a bug that impacts, you know, isn't availability impacting, I think this has been, you know, addressed really, really quickly because of the hype. So, you know, these numbers are pretty good.
It has. Now, you know, towards the end of our discussion around Heartbleed last week, I mentioned that, you know, someone had told me Juniper equipment was affected. Cisco equipment as well, also OpenVPN applications, or, you know, all sorts of stuff. And, you know, this is kind of what we expected. But, you know, as we were saying, the response to this has been pretty good. And, you know, patches are rolling out left, right and center. And, you know, hopefully if you're using, you know, equipment from a halfway decent vendor, you'll be able to patch it. But, I mean, there's always going to be those, you know, sort of set and forget VPN deployments that people aren't going to bother with, right?
Yeah, and I think some of the Cisco stuff they were talking about is things like, you know, IP phones and messaging platforms. So, like, not core, like, router and switchy stuff, but still, you know, embedded systems that are, you know, I mean, patching your IP phones and conferencing stuff, like, that can be quite tedious. So we may see these bugs in that kind of equipment for quite some time. The OpenVPN one was certainly interesting because, you know, that's a fairly widespread open source VPN solution. But in the default configuration where you're using layered TLS auth, it does seem that mitigates against Heartbleed in that case, which is going to save quite a few people the problem. But yeah, it's exactly what we're expecting to see. As each vendor or each, you know, set of developers that work on a product that uses SSL start to investigate what exactly is in process, what is likely to get leaked, you know, then we'll see a better understanding of how it affects like non-web server products.
Now, I've had a bit of interesting to and fro with a journalist from the Sydney Morning Herald, Ben Grubb, who's preparing a story really arguing that Google was irresponsible in its disclosure process with this because they held onto the bug for at least 11 days, patched their servers first. Looks like they probably let a few of their mates know so that they could take care of their systems. Then they went to OpenSSL. And, you know, it's kind of funny seeing this pop up as a mainstream media issue, but people are like, well, hang on, shouldn't there be some sort of coordinated, process where there's like an early alert system? And it's like, well, no, because they all... because they all leak. But it looks like there is going to be a little bit of a media backlash against Google for hanging on to it. What's your take, Adam?
Well, yeah, this is it's a discussion that is worth having because when we...
I don't know. I think it's kind of a discussion we've had a few times in the last 20 years, you know.
This is where I was getting there. And let's face it, in the industry, we've had this discussion and we've figured out how we're going to do it. And this kind of, slightly coordinated full disclosure is what we've arrived at as the only real practical option. And full disclosure obviously does, result in impact to, innocent kind of bystanders and, fully closed, trusted vendor only, distribution systems always leak. And we've seen that over the years with a number of the private communities that do that. And for a bug that's as big as this one or as big as the DNS one or whatever, they absolutely will leak. And I think, laying that criticism that at Google's feet for, you didn't tell everyone immediately, that does seem a little unfair. I mean, I guess, from my point of view, this is Google's return on investing in security, right? Of having, a highly skilled and I presume well-paid security team that does this kind of research. So they get the benefit of that, which is advanced notification of the bugs by virtue of finding them. And if you're Yahoo and, maybe you don't spend quite so much money on security, well, this is what it costs you.
Yeah.
I don't think really laying that at Google's feet is fair. Like Google have done a good job of handling this my reading of it.
11 days is, pretty remarkable turnaround. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of a couple of things here. First of all, Google's obligation is to Google's users and to its own system. So of course they're going to get their own ducks in a row before they start helping other people. If they happen to give a few people a heads up, then, there's nothing really wrong with that. And the other thing that occurs to me is, OpenSSL is open source software. I mean, you can't silently or quietly commit a patch. I mean, as soon as you commit a patch to this thing, it's going to be obvious what's being patched. And, there is no choice but to fully disclose it. That's just the nature of open source.
Well, yeah, there's a few.
Even closed source, you can reverse it, right? But I mean, this is just like, it's going to pop into, it's going to be committed somewhere. Change is going to be committed. People are going to spot it.
Yeah, I mean, some open source projects do have some open source projects. Sound like open horse, and I don't want you to take that the wrong way, like Mt. Gox. Some open source projects, they do have some sort of, secret restricted skunkworks way of doing security, tracking security bugs, like taking security bugs, tracking them, patching them, and then doing that out of repository so that it doesn't leak. And that's a process that, in say like Mozilla's case, for example, sometimes works. But it is pretty difficult to get right. And I don't know that the OpenSSL team is quite as dynamic as some of the more hip open source products. But it is very, very hard to do right. And as you say, like either way, if it's closed source, we reverse the patches on Patch Tuesday. And if it's open source, we read the bug tracker and source repositories. Either way, it's going to leak, and it's going to leak fast. And full disclosure is the way that works in the end. It's the only one that has worked really well for us.
Now, look, actually, you just mentioned Mt. Gox there. As an aside, Mt. Gox are actually liquidating. They had been involved in a bit of a court process with the government. Turns out, they wanted to sort of salvage the operation. Mt. Gox is going to liquidate, so it is no more. But look, staying with Heartbleed, and I was contacted by an old buddy, another journalist, Adam Turner, who was really looking at this idea of whether or not two-factor authentication would have saved you as a, saved your creds if you were a everyday internet user. If you were using a soft token, would it have saved you? And he asked the question, surely you could actually steal someone's token seed value if you've got access to process memory. And I thought, well, maybe, yeah. So it might be that if you're using a soft token, if that's being done in process, that could be your token seed value could be at risk, and you might be just as at risk as someone who's just using a username and password.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting discussion. For certain forms of two-factor auth, that would be something that you could imagine. I mean, the sort of the classic OP style, iterated MD5 Which, if you were doing that in process, you know, through an Apache module or something, then it's not unreasonable that those seed values would be in memory and you would be able to jack them. And I guess another aspect that's worth considering in the two-factor discussion is that if you are stealing session cookies out of web server memory, those are post-auth, right? And if you, you know, if you go through the two-factor authentication, get your session cookie and carry back your business, and you don't have subsequent per transaction two-factor, like some banks do for money transfers, you have to auth again via second factor. But if you're doing like straight up login two-factor and you steal a session cookie, then that doesn't matter. So the interaction with two-factor is an interesting one. And I guess it depends on, you know, how you use two-factor in your app, how you, like what specific technology you're using. If you're using, you know, like just out-of-band SMS delivery of a code, then it's kind of a different scenario.
Well,
than
maybe,
if you're generating
maybe.
Them, yeah.
I mean, that code that's being SMS to the user, that's going to appear in memory somewhere. I mean, that's likely going to be in a different process, probably even in a different box. You know what I mean? You probably just go request an OTP. You know, it SMSs it in one direction and then sends it back to the web app server on, you know, in the other direction. But if that is being done in process, I mean, it's theoretically possible that an attacker could, you know, manage to steal it. So if you're walking down the street one day and you get a text message from your bank saying use code, you know, 5672, to authorize the transfer of $40,000 to Evil Hackers Incorporated, that could be what's going on.
You work exactly. I guess at any point of time when you are accidentally, you know, or your phone says you're sending money to Honest Ahmed, then yeah, you might want to do something about that, regardless of Heartbleed. But I guess this really does demonstrate the importance of understanding the actual like implementation architecture of the systems you're using, which in a cloud world is very, very difficult. And you know, as a consumer, it's very hard to make an educated decision, you know, when you don't know about the internals of everybody's apps, right? It's a fun place to be.
Now, moving on to what I think is a bit of a controversial story, and Bloomberg is carrying some news that says that Heartbleed was being exploited by the NSA for up to 2 years. It quotes two unnamed sources, and this story appeared, I think, the day after Kim Zeta ran a story at Wired, sort of raising it as a question. And then very conveniently, Bloomberg has two anonymous sources who are prepared to say, yes, they knew about it for years. This prompted a denial by the NSA, a rare denial. I think it was the director. It came from Director of National Intelligence. He said, we didn't know about the bug and we didn't use it. So this is, you know, this story actually throws some question marks up for me. And you know why? Because it's too perfect. It is just too perfect. Stories like this don't happen. I got to say, I'm very suspicious of it.
Yeah, it was an interesting, but certainly, you know, the days around Heartbleed were interesting in the mainstream media at the start. And then when this story came out, it was, it did stand out from the rest of them by virtue of, you know, actually straight up saying, there's lots of speculation that, you know, of course the NSA want this bug or have this bug, but to actually say, we have sources that say that this is a bug they had and that they were using it, you know, it's a pretty strong assertion. And I guess, you know, we don't see, you know, strongly attributed statements to these sources in these kinds of stories. It just doesn't happen. But it, you know, it could be true.
It could be true. That's not my argument. My argument is not that the NSA was or was not using this bug. My argument is Bloomberg didn't know. This story smells.
Yeah, it does. And of course, I would love to see more information to back it up. But, you know, just going on what Bloomberg says, yeah, it is. It's hard to say whether or not you're willing to suspend your disbelief or not.
I mean, but the story could be true, but that's an accident. Okay. Do you know what I mean? When I see journalism like this, it just makes me think, you know, this is the story. This is the question that everyone wants the answer to.
Yeah.
And you've been able to answer it very easily with two sources that you won't name.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, no, I certainly see what you're saying there. I would love to see some more info.
As I say, the NSA has denied that report. So, you know, it's impossible to know. You've got, who knows? We're not going to know, but let's just keep an eye on Bloomberg and see what other perfect news they managed to break. Now, apparently Obama has come out and said, you know, the NSA absolutely must reveal bugs like Heartbleed, unless they're useful,
yeah,
which I love.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, it's a beautiful segue, I suppose, from the story about the NSA having Heartbleed allegedly and, you know, using it allegedly to this discussion about exactly how the NSA assesses the impact of vulnerabilities that it has and whether or not it needs to keep them quiet and use them, or whether the, you know, the net benefit is in, you know, telling people about it, getting it fixed. And apparently there is a, you know, a relatively robust process inside the NSA already for assessing that. And Obama has come out and there were some recommendations a while ago, which basically said that there should be a better process, which says that the presumption is you should disclose your bugs, and unless there is a very good reason, you know, that you really do need to keep it secret so that you can use it. Like, there was very kind of a, sort of a stronger barrier, and Obama has
because if we talk about this one, then we can't use it to own people anymore. I would have thought that'd be the standard reason.
Well, I mean, yeah, obviously, and you know, you imagine there's a difference between the sort of the fluffy policy that everyone likes to believe is what happens and what actually has to happen, which is you find an awesome bug and then you use it until you can't.
But I mean, come on. I mean, you know, we've all heard stories about, you know, the US government and not just NSA, but all sorts of other sort of cyber equipped divisions and the massive pile of ODA that they're sitting on. It just seems like, come on, you know, this isn't what's happening. I mean, if they drop their ODA catalog, it'd keep every vendor on the planet busy for weeks, months, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And what's the point of having all these tens of thousands of people doing cybers if they don't have anything to cyber shoot with, you know, any web cyber weapons, right? You don't
internet weapons.
Internet weapons, yes, that's what they don't. Yeah, we can't. They're not going to give up their internet weapons.
Now, look, moving to the US courts now, and Lavabit, which was Edward Snowden's email provider, they were the guys who said, we will not cough up our keys. And then the government was like, yes, you are. And then they've appealed and they've lost their appeal. So basically, when the government pops up with a national security order saying, give us your keys, you kind of have to. But it's interesting enough that the appeal was dismissed more or less on a technicality.
Yeah, so the appeal was dismissed, you know, because... the guy from Lavabit, Leto Levison, apparently represented himself in the first round of court proceedings and, of course, failed to do all the process stuff right. And then subsequently, of course, the appeal gets thrown out on, yeah, essentially procedural process-related stuff. And as a result, the court doesn't really get to rule on all of the actual important things that we would like them to rule on, which is, you know, like, yes, we know all us nerds are smart at nerdy things, but get a lawyer, you know, rather than
I am,
you know,
not a lawyer. I mean, people say that it's abbreviated.
Yeah, well, exactly,
sakes,
right.
You know?
So you know, it's that's a bit frustrating, but you know, I guess we'll see where it goes from here. But
oh, we'll wait for the next one. I mean, he's sort of paved the way to show people that you can fight it, and you know, it's probably worked out quite well for him in terms of building his profile, and you know, he's got a lot of warm and fuzzies around him now for fighting the man. So you know.
Yeah, but on the other hand, like, you know, I suppose if you're the sort of guy that names your servers after your ex-girlfriend, yeah, I guess he probably needs all the warm fuzzies he can get.
Yeah, that's a little bit creepy.
I know, right?
Now, staying with the courts and Weave. You know, the Free Weave movement, man, has succeeded.
God.
Weave is out, man. The court has overturned his conviction, again, on a technicality, because he was being, he'd been convicted in, I think, in, or being, it was being charged in New Jersey, and they're like, well, okay, New Jersey had nothing to do with it, so they tossed the case. He had a bunch of very good lawyers working pro bono on this, but, you know, Wired is carrying this story with Weave throwing up his right fist, you know, because he's all about freedom and, you know, rights and stuff.
God.
So there he is, folk hero Weave, out of the pounding in the ass.
Jesus, how did we end up at this? But yeah, I mean, you know, I guess we all would have liked to have seen this fought on grounds of the, you know, the overreach of the CFAA rather than it's in the wrong state. But I guess I do I have to say good for Weave? I do, don't I?
You do.
Good for Weave, right? He's free and he can eat bacon or whatever now. And maybe he's learned a lesson, you know, maybe it will actually be good for Weave, but...
well, you wonder what he's going to do next.
Well, exactly. Like, what do you, like, well, I guess he can go on Oprah and have a speaking tour or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Who knows?
Dear. Anyway, yeah, he got off and I would have been nice to see it fought. You know, over the things, the issues that were actually important in this case.
But that's not how it works, man.
Like, but yeah, that's not how it works.
TrueCrypt has finally been audited. There's been a two-stage audit happening of TrueCrypt. It's apparently passed the first stage of its audit in flying colors. Apparently, no backdoors in TrueCrypt, as far as we know, which is good.
Yeah, and the people doing the review, ISEC, are certainly pretty competent, and the outcome of the review is essentially there's some implementation flaws, which you'd expect with any piece of software, but no, obvious backdoors, nothing obviously wrong, which is nice and reassuring, and hopefully they'll go through and fix the some of the implementation bugs that they did show up, and we'll all have a better crypto product because of it. So yay, this is a win.
Yeah, well, I think they're moving second phase of the audit is more to do with the actual crypto rather than just, the functional aspects of the code. So, yeah, I mean, I guess you can have more confidence when you're using it. But
Which is good.
Hopefully they iron out some of the sort of bugs, because I can pretty reliably get a few things to kernel panic when I'm using certain combinations of algorithms, Yay. Wow.
Yeah, it probably just disagrees badly with, your NSA kernel implants or whatever. Yeah,
pretty much. Now, the hardware manufacturer Lacy, they make external hard disks and all that sort of stuff. They were actually acquired by Seagate a while ago. But pretty much everyone who shopped on an online, on Lacy's online website, as opposed to their offline website, nice thinking there, Pat. everyone who shopped with Lacy over a period of about a year would have lost their details. Yay.
Yeah, so it looks like they got owned by Cold Fusion Technique is what's being reported there. Yeah, Krebs says that it was Cold Fusion Technique, and they've been owned for something like a year, which is leading to allegedly 38 million or so customer credit cards and other details stolen out of there. So it's not a good look. Krebs apparently dropped this something like a month ago, and we're only starting to see confirmation out of Seagate spokespeople since then. They've got a forensics company on the job. They're trying to figure it out. They've shut down their online store in the meantime. But yeah, yet another pretty big data breach and, yet more Cold Fusion ownage.
Yeah, well, Krebs has another interesting piece up, actually, which is talking about, some bad guys going after tax returns in the US and, filing fraudulent tax returns and using crimeware to, grab creds and data that are actually going to help with that. And the reason I find this interesting is anytime there's an opportunity for this sort of fraud, I mean, people tend to move in to fill the gaps, particularly in the United States. I mean, I think we're quite fortunate living in Australia and New Zealand in that the United States is such a big market. People tend to tailor these types of attacks to it. We haven't seen the same level of fraud here or this level of sophistication, but it looks like a pretty awesome scam.
Yeah, so they were running a scam that they had a kind of like centralized system that they would break into HR systems, collect all the data necessary to file tax returns, and they had like a website, a web application that like did all of the kept track of all the people's data and all of the tax returns they were submitting and where they return refunds, which of course that's the point of the fraud, is to file a tax return that claims you're eligible for a refund and then have those refunds directed somewhere else. And they had quite a sophisticated sort of workflow application for managing that, and they were getting the refunds sent to like prepaid Amex debit cards or something like that, and then using that to cash out through Mule. So quite a fancy operation, and for the people affected, one of the more damaging in terms of how involved it is to recover from sorts of identity theft. And it looks like they were making pretty real money. And I guess we're lucky that the Australian New Zealand markets are too small to sustain, or so far, to really sustain this kind of fairly nasty fraud.
I love it that you use the word fancy to describe a criminal activity. That's unreal. Now, look, just a bit of technical news here. Microsoft has updated its threat modeling tool. That's part of its secure development lifecycle stuff. Part of its big trustworthy computing initiative. I like it when Microsoft does stuff like this because obviously the guys and gals are working on this internally, trying to improve their own processes, and they're quite cool about sharing this stuff because I guess, if you're creating tools that help developers write more secure apps for your platform, it benefits your platform. So good. This is just good business for them and good for everyone else.
Yeah, it's certainly, if you're into threat modeling, it is worth looking into. And I guess everyone who is managing threats in their workplace, in their business environment, really, you do need to be doing fairly detailed threat modeling. And having a tool and a framework that helps you with that is a very good thing. And, it's funny, over the years, Microsoft has done, as you say, like a very, robust job of improving their security lifecycle and their tools and their software. And, the idea of Microsoft as a thought leader in security is still a thing that is, seems kind of weird after the good old days of the worms of the early 2000s. But, they are doing a good job. So yeah, good for them. And, it's worth looking into if you are doing this kind of thing.
Now, moving on to our next story, Microsoft has done something incredibly stupid and bad. Which is, they're releasing...
Windows 8.
Well, they've released their Windows 8.1 update, right? Which was in itself, it was kind of a problematic patch. There were problems with people, you know, trying to install this. And now they've released advice saying, unless you have that 8.1 patch, we won't give you any more patches for, you know, any more future updates. What is going on over there?
It's a good question. What exactly is going on over there? And I suppose what I imagine is that it's difficult to patch Windows 8 for some reason, and someone decided that it was reasonable just to expect everybody to update, which, I mean, it's probably not. And I imagine they'll end up fixing this if this gets too much traction in the press.
Look,
they just got to throw some money and test facilities at it and actually sort it out, because, you know, this is not going to, I just don't think that this situation is going to last, where people will end up with a, you know, Windows 8.0 box that's not patchable. Like, yeah, they'll fix that.
Well, because otherwise, I mean, you know, we flash forward a couple of months, there are going to be people who, for whatever reason, didn't get that update, and now they're having trouble, and, you know, then you've got some decent bugs in that code base that start getting passed around, their owners start getting hosed, everyone gets angry, turns into a huge press issue. You know, Microsoft, I have noticed, when they tend to make dumb and easy to fix, or, you know, at least fixable decisions, you know, really when the press turns on the heat, that's when they start to react. It shouldn't be that way, but it is.
Well, it's process, right? They just have to do it. Like, someone wanted to save some budget somewhere, and, you know, so I guess somebody else's budget will fix it, and then the world will carry on.
Well, we're going to end with a quick story here about some bugs. Oracle has released a patch, 104 vulnerabilities. Hey, at least they're fixing them. I think 34 of them are in Java.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, it sounds like a lot of bugs, but they do have a lot of products.
They have a lot of software, and a lot of it came to them through acquisition. There's no uniform code base. I mean, you know, it's easy to point at them and go, ha, 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 you know, but still.
On the other hand, you still need to go and patch all these stupid bugs. So there's something like 20 bugs in the Fusion middleware set of platforms, and like 37 in Java, plus a couple of real nasty ones in the actual database.
Yeah, well, that's what caught my attention too, you know, is that actual proper rigid edge database bugs.
Yeah, and I mean, that's obviously a bad thing, because, you know, people typically don't put unimportant stuff in their Oracle databases. But on the other hand, if you're near an Oracle database on the network, you know, near enough to exploit these things, you're probably already winning. But either way, you're still going to have to go fix everything, all of the Oracle things.
But the good news is, shells. I mean, as Larry Ellison told us, no one's ever hacked an Oracle database. So why even bother patching? I mean, you know.
Well, exactly. By the power of Larry, you'll be by the power of Larry, you will be protected.
All righty, man. That's actually it for the news this week, Adam. Thanks a lot for joining us. We'll chat to you again next week.
See you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Now, before we move on, some time ago, you may have recalled that I mentioned browserassessment.com. It's a project I'm involved in, and there's been a lot of work done on it over the last few months. Now, basically, with browser assessment, you can configure your border device to pass off all of the browsers connecting out from your network, and get your border device to basically hand off a connection to our servers via via script injection. It's pretty simple. BA then scans your browsers and matches versions to vulns. That's browsers and plugins. And from there, you can log into a nice, pretty control panel and see all of the awful, awful things connecting out from your network. Yay! So unlike a passive scanner, it'll show you things like, plugins that aren't actually firing as they pass your gateway. I mean, it's on your network, but if it's Silverlight, I mean, users might not be actually hitting any Silverlight, so those plugins aren't firing and you won't see them. You'll find BYOD devices on your network, and it'll profile them. It'll find you machines that have gone out of policy, ones that don't have the latest vuln scanner installed, and basically it'll just give you visibility that on one hand you really, really want, and on the other hand is really, really terrifying. But it's, you know, it's absolutely worth doing. Now, the reason I'm talking about this is there is ready-to-go F5 support now. So if you're using F5 gear and you'd like to try BA, it is free. And there's an F5 rule there already. So all you need to do is cut and paste it, and then you can go berserk capturing vulnerable browser information from your network. This is a cloud service, right? So it's very, very easy. So if you've got any questions about it, email me, patrick@risky.biz. Otherwise, just go sign up at browserassessment.com, and it'll walk you through the setup process. But yeah, enough of that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Andrew Wilson, the chief executive of Senitas. Senatas makes all sorts of terribly hip Layer 2 encryption gear, and as I mentioned at the top of the show, if you're doing any type of Greenfields deployment, now is the time to look at Layer 2 encryption. Not later, do it now. So do go check out Senatas at senatas.com. But Andrew is joining us to talk about the somewhat depressing results of a survey that company did in the Australian market with regard to the changes to Australia's Privacy Act that took effect on March 12. As you'll hear, the results basically tell us that to get the corporate world to really take security seriously, we're going to need a bigger stick. Even though there's $1.7 million fines now here for Privacy Act breaches. But yeah, apparently no one cares. And, you know, Andrew likens current attitudes towards information security and things like the Privacy Act to attitudes 30 to 50 years ago in the sort of construction and mining sectors towards occupational health and safety. I mean, this was something that, well, you know, hey, we lost a few guys last week, but in order to do this safely, it would cost too much. It's, you know, it was sort of in the too hard basket. It's a really interesting way of looking at things. So I got Andrew on Skype and started off by asking him to tell us what the changes to Australia's Privacy Act actually looked like.
Well, basically, they've harmonised the privacy principles to apply equally between government and business. So previously, they were out of step. There was one set of privacy principles that applied to businesses and another that applied to government, so they've harmonised those. They've introduced significant penalties, well, significant in their view, but not necessarily significant in the case of a business's view. And one of the reforms that they were going to introduce that did miss the final sitting of Parliament but was tabled by the previous government was to introduce mandatory data breach notification. Sadly, that did miss the last sitting of Parliament is now not included in this current set of reforms.
Yeah, I do note, though, that I think it's still bubbling around there somewhere in Canberra. I think we might see that one actually hit the Senate at some point soon. So essentially it's been beefed up, the Privacy Act has been beefed up, and whereas previously the Privacy Commissioner could say you were just involved in the most egregious act of the violation of all of your customers' privacy, I am fining you $500 and I'm going to call you naughty. I believe that is now kicked up to $1.7 million, which you would think would be a pretty decent stick to work with.
Yeah, look, it's $1.7 million for a breach for a corporation or $340,000 if an individual is found guilty of such a breach. But, even $1.7 million, if you contrast the European approach to the fines, they're currently tabled equivalent reforms to the European EU approach to privacy, 100 million euros. I mean, that's a bit different to $1.7 million, don't you think?
Well, $1.7 million isn't exactly going to make a company start fearing for its survival if those sorts of fines are levied. Now, this is what brings us to the reason we're doing this interview, is you guys went out and did a survey. You contacted 50 organisations, spoke to people at varying levels from executive through to sort of IT manager and stuff to try to get a handle of whether or not organisations were ready for these changes. And the resounding answer was, no, we are not ready. And I don't think we are going to be ready anytime soon.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was astounding at the end of the day. It was 74% of the organisations we spoke to said they're highly unlikely to be ready at all. And certainly not within the next 2 years, you know, so that's an astounding statistic. You know, 32% of the 74% said it was going to take, 2 years to get ready. 41% said they didn't understand what was required. I mean, that's a problem in itself, and they need to get some pretty good legal advice on that, I would have thought. And with only 15% said that they'd be confident and ready, in short order. So,
now, a lot of that really would come down to, sort of compliance readiness, because, all the Australian Privacy Act really has to say about security is that it's something you should do. It is something you should do to a reasonable standard. So to a degree, this is more just about a cultural readiness rather than a technological readiness. But before we did this interview, you gave me the most brilliant analogy for this apathy that we see when it comes to InfoSec and organizations where they're like, yeah, we're not ready, but we're not so worried about it because the fine's only 1.7 million and that's the worst that could happen. And you compared this to attitudes towards occupational health and safety from 50 years ago, where it was perfectly acceptable to have a few workers killed when embarking on a, you know, on a big building project because, well, hey, people just die. Whereas these days, those sort of accidents are much, much rarer because we've accepted that safety needs to be baked into the culture, particularly around things like construction and mining.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as I mentioned to you earlier in that little chat, 50 years ago, yeah, injuring a person injured on the work site was a cost of doing business. You know, it happened, it was unfortunate, and it was very sad, but it was a cost of doing business. And obviously, the government looked at this and said things need to change from a regulatory perspective because that sort of attitude is just not good enough. And with the introduction of the OH&S legislation in this country, completely revolutionised the approach to occupational health and safety. And now today, it's unthinkable that you would expose an employee to harm in the workplace. And I think that's where we need to get to with information security. You know, we hear time and time again about significant breaches and loss of personal information and theft of intellectual property and government surveillance. You know, and I believe that serious regulation with criminal sanctions for negligence need to be introduced in the country. And directors need to be responsible for the actions of their company to ensure that, you know, sensitive information is appropriately protected, whether that's company information in the form of intellectual property or whether that's personal information that an organisation is entrusted to deal with. My view is it's a serious director's duty, and people need to be held accountable for their actions in relation to that information.
Now, I want to circle back to that in a minute, but I mean, it is fair to say that you actually did receive some feedback through this survey process that the threat of penalty, the threat of these fines, wasn't actually enough to really get people motivated. I got to say, I found that quite surprising.
Yeah, well, I mean that's very true. Most of the respondents did say that, you know, whilst $1.7 million was a bit of money, it wasn't anywhere near enough to get them to, you know, immediately overhaul their approach to IT security, and they'd be more willing to self-insure with that sort of penalty. It wasn't really a whole lot in the scheme of things for a large organisation compared with the cost of, of implementing the sort of security environment that I think they need to.
Well, and this is what makes the OH&S analogy fit so closely, is because the attitude is very similar, isn't it? It's like, you know, you can imagine some site manager 50 years ago going, well, yeah, I mean, we could do it safely, but can you imagine how much that's going to cost and all of the processes we're going to have to put in place? And like, come on, it's just not realistic. I mean, that's what makes it all click for me. But I guess, you know, going back to that, circling back to the issue of directors' liability, you mentioned one thing could be criminal sanctions. We're seeing in the United States, a few potential legal actions sort of being launched at Target over their data breach. Whether or not they succeed, the consensus in legal circles seems to be that an action like this will succeed eventually, which might actually change the liability equation for a lot of organizations in the future. Really, you seem to say that criminal sanctions against directors who are grossly negligent would certainly be a step in the right direction.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you've been grossly negligent with the intention of wrongdoing, then under the Australian Corporations Act, that can attract criminal sanctions. Well, you know, failing to take the appropriate steps or deliberately ignoring the warning signs as a director might cause you to breach the director's duties in the Corporations Act. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, whether some of these high-profile breaches in the US, for example, do attract that sort of attention from the regulators and also that sort of attention on directors' duties. You know, we need one of these high-profile breaches to be adjudicated through the courts so that the proper definitions and interpretations of a company's responsibilities in relation to sensitive data and IT security can be better defined.
Well, I think one of the other issues that makes the OH&S thing fit so precisely is that, you know, occupational health and safety initiatives are really seen as an absolutely necessary cost But before this was an absolutely mandatory, you know, we will put you out of business and shut you down sort of compliance regime. It was just seen as a cost, sort of nice to have. I think that's kind of where InfoSec is now. That was something else that came through really heavily in the survey results that you guys shared with me, is that IT security is just seen as a you know, cost black hole. There's nothing, you know, we've seen the security industry for 10 years now trying to sort of sell security as this great enabler. And, you know, I think to a degree that that's kind of failed. I mean, it is seen by large businesses as a cost. Would you agree with that?
Completely. Absolutely. You know, one of the best ways to protect sensitive information is through encrypting that information. You know, it's today, I'm sure you would agree that it's almost impossible to prevent a breach completely. So, you know, when we talk to customers about encrypting their information, and this was born out in our research, you know, 90% of those who we polled said that data security planning is driven by commercial factors rather than any overriding requirement or need to protect sensitive information, including intellectual property. So, you know, they were more concerned about saving and pinching pennies. I mean, ultimately, you know, if you look at the implementation of the OH&S legislation, I think, you know, if you were to go back and have a look at the last 50 years, especially the last 20 years of this active legislation, I think it would say it's decreased the company's cost of doing business. You know, and I think ultimately, IT InfoSec, if planned and implemented properly in an organisation, can reduce the cost of doing business overall.
How's that? Just because if you're actually careful about the way you plan your IT infrastructure, it tends to run better. I mean, that's always been, I thought, a selling point for good InfoSec. You know, secure networks tend to be well-run networks.
Well-run networks, safe networks, and ultimately, you know, as a country as well, we've got to be a safe country to do business in. You know, it's about the value of the digital economy, and you've got to have trust in that. And this has got to be, you know, the focus of a robust approach to IT security.
All right. Well, Andrew Wilson, thank you very much for joining us on the program to have a bit of a chat about the somewhat disturbing results of a survey your company Senatas did.
Fantastic, Patrick, mate. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it. And we'll speak soon.
Andrew Wilson, CEO of Senatas there. Big thanks to our sponsor, Senatas, a publicly listed Australian company. Do go check them out at senatas.com. And that is it for this week's show. This week's track is by the Delta Riggs, because they're playing in my town on Saturday night, and I think I might actually go see them. This one's called Supersonic Casualties. Have a great Easter break, everyone. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
To let you through. Shame, shame, now it's gone. People wanna carry on like they were a saint obsession. We were marching around in our mama late shoes. To make